listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The New York Times reported in January that the political network overseen by the conservative billionaires Charles and David Koch plans to spend close to $900 million on the 2016 campaign. This puts their contributions on a par with the total spending of both the Democratic and Republican parties. Gary Hart, the former U.S. Senator from Colorado and presidential contender, writes in his latest book, The Republic of Conscience, that this is not what the founding fathers intended campaigns to be, that campaigns that cost billions and are controlled by narrow interests are antithetical to their ideas. The book is published by Blue Rider Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Gary Hart back to our show. Hello.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be back.
Now, you've taken the title of your book from a poem by Seamus Heaney. You've been spending a fair amount of time in Ireland. So are you reading Irish poets these days?
Not just these days. I've read Yeats all my life and discovered Heaney in rather late in life. I have been active in Northern Ireland on behalf of John Kerry in recent months. But I also used to go to the west of Ireland and write books.
Now, his poem is called From the Republic of Conscience, and you quote a few lines from the beginning of your book. No porters, no interpreter, no taxi. You carried your own burden, and very soon your symptoms of creeping privilege disappeared. At their inauguration, public leaders must swear to uphold unwritten law and weep to atone for their presumption to hold office. Now, he was Irish. Does this also apply to the character of American leaders?
Yes, it does. In fact, I had written the book and was searching for a title and ran across this poem entitled The Republic of Conscience. And a chill went up my spine because it fits so well. The book is about recapturing the classic definition of a republic, which our founders created, and restoring integrity to government.
And you're right that the founding fathers knew when they created a republic that if they look back to Athens and Rome, it would be vulnerable to corruption, which takes the form of narrow individual and special interests.
Yes.
So human nature never changes.
It doesn't. And that kind of corruption was the death of all republics previous to ours. And Ben Franklin said this: we've created a republic if you can keep it. And the idea of this kind of corruption, not bribery, money under the table, but special interests over the common good, really worried them.
But don't the Koch brothers, for example, claim that they have a libertarian vision and that's the reason they're willing to spend all that money? In the case of Sheldon Adelson, it has to do with mostly his support of Israel.
Well, up until the Supreme Court decision in Citizens United, most people would have said there should be constraints on the amount of money any individual or interest can contribute. And as you well know, we've had cycles of campaign reform, finance reform, and we keep trying to keep big money from dominating our politics. But the Supreme Court has legalized this kind of corruption.
McCain-Feingold was supposed to have a real impact, but it never seemed to really have one.
It did for a while, and it really, I claim a bit of credit. Before the two of them invented this, I was an early advocate in the 70s of campaign finance reform because I saw the genie getting out of the bottle even at that time, and that led to McCain-Feingold, and it worked for a while until it began to be eroded.
Do you remember how much money you had to raise in 1975 when you first ran for the Senate?
74. In a contested six-way primary against a two-term incumbent, I raised and spent $375,000.
And that was it?
That was it. $17 average contribution.
But I suspect your opponents weren't raising all that much more.
Well, the incumbent that I defeated spent probably four or five times that. Mm-hmm. 6 years later, when I ran for re-election, I had to raise and spend $1 million, three times that amount, and I was outspent.
Politicians complain that so much of their time is spent raising funds when they could be doing much more important work.
Absolutely true. And former colleagues of mine say they go to the party headquarters, both parties, 2 hours a day and do nothing but make fundraising phone calls.
Do you believe that the role of money in elections is the main corrupting force, or are there other equally powerful factors?
It's all connected, as I argue in the book, with the explosive growth of the lobbying industry, and it is an industry. It's now a $4 billion annual industry. Over 400 former members of Congress are now lobbyists.
Should they be restricted from entering lobbying for at least for a time?
Like 25 years. A year or two at least.
Yeah, but they go right from their office in the Senate of the House and into a lobbying firm.
They do. They do. And make a lot of money.
Why is there a refusal to enact strict campaign finance reforms in Congress? Or is that a silly question?
Oh, I've never recall receiving a silly question from you.
No, but I mean, you know, maybe that question answers itself.
Well, when the highest court in the land legitimizes corporations as individuals under the First Amendment and then permits them to spend unlimited amounts of money pursuing their own particular interest, the cat is out of the bag. It's legalized corruption.
One of the biggest expenses for a campaign is television ads.
Yes.
Wasn't there an idea in the past about offering free airtime on the networks for political advertising?
It's an argument I've made all for the last 30 or 40 years. The airwaves, as you well know, belong to the American people. They don't belong to NBC or anyone else. They're licensed by the people of the United States through the government. So we can require electronic media, not print, but electronic media to make time available, as they do in most European democracies. But once again, the television lobby in America is too powerful.
Also, European campaigns tend to be much shorter.
Yes.
We could shorten ours. So right now, we are in the midst of intense campaigning, and we're over a year and a half away from the next election.
Yeah. Self-interest requires me to resist calendar limitations because dark horse candidates, less well-known, need a long time in a country this size to get better known, and that was my experience.
Bernie Sanders, obviously, trying that kind of campaign. Why doesn't spending by liberals like George Soros and Tom Steyer simply balance out the spending by wealthy conservatives like the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson?
I think you'd have to do the mathematics, which I have not done, between liberal progressive contributors and conservative. But so much of this money is corporate money, and no one has believed that corporations end up on the liberal side of the spectrum. So I expect that in terms of balance, it's heavily weighted towards conservatism.
Well, Hillary Clinton's campaign is now estimated to cost perhaps $1.3 billion. So Democrats are also going after that kind of money, and they probably have to go after the same kinds of contributors.
Well, shame on them. This is not a partisan book. This is a systemic book that's about the whole system. There have been people in the Clinton campaign say they may spend as much as $2.5 billion.
Wow. In the wake of the Charleston shooting, there's a new political will to remove Confederate flags from public spaces. But it's been pointed out again and again, there's been no meaningful conversation about gun control. And when you look at the spending on lobbying and contributions in 2013, 2014 by gun rights groups, it's $31 million, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. In your own state, Colorado, weren't some legislators punished by voters for supporting a gun control measure in the wake of the Aurora movie killings?
Oh, they were. They were recalled, and state legislators, two or three of them, and dismissed from office on this issue. Yeah, as you well know, this is the single issue constituency of America. That's the members of the NRA care only about gun control, nothing else.
But if other people want gun control, then how come those legislators were recalled? Obviously, voters are going along with the NRA,
or not voting. A lot of people will tell pollsters that they want gun control and then not turn up when the votes are counted.
Well, shame on them then.
Shame on them.
My guest is Gary Hart, whose latest book is The Republic of Conscience. What do you imagine that Washington, Adams, Hamilton, Madison, and Jefferson, among others, would think of the American Republic today?
They'd be appalled. I think just reading what they said to each other, what they wrote, what they argued, they really genuinely feared this form of special interest corruption. So they would have to be appalled.
Well, they were, at that time when they wrote the Constitution, Supreme Court didn't have the kind of role in politics it has today. But the Supreme Court over the years has been both a positive and a negative force in American politics.
Yes. But the court only came along recently in Citizens United and other opinions to ratify a corrupting system, if you will, that was well underway. And the issue was, would the Supreme Court ratify this corruption and the explosive growth of it and the combination with campaign finance, or would they resist it? And they ratified it.
The founding fathers, you write, anticipated that there would be special interests, but they hoped that elected officials would think about the national interest.
They called it the common good, which comes from ancient Athens.
So has that idea just been lost?
It
probably was lost fairly early in the American democracy.
I think more in the 20th century with the rise of dominant special interests. I'm a student of American history, but I'm not Arthur Schlesinger. But you
do have a doctorate in political theory.
From Oxford, yes. Mm.
So you know all about British political theory?
No, I wrote about Thomas Jefferson to the amusement of the Brits. No, I'm still not Arthur Schlesinger. What I'm saying is that in my lifetime, since I served in the 70s and 80s, this systemic corruption has occurred. Now, we have always had lobbyists. That you can't outlaw lobbying. But you can control the connection between the lobbyists and the financing of campaigns. That can be controlled.
Well, it's just the name, the lobbyists. They used to wait in the lobby.
Yes.
They're not waiting in the lobbies anymore.
They are not. And I will tell you a tipping point in my own life. In 1979, I was getting ready to run for re-election. A group of Coloradans came in, brought in by the Washington representative of their organization. And when they left, after a nice discussion, my administrative assistant brought in an envelope, and in it was a check for $2,000 for my reelection campaign. I had him run down the hall and give it back to them. I was not going to require people to make a contribution to talk to me. And that, to me, and I was dumbfounded, and that was the beginning of this system.
You're right that the first principles of every constitution must be frequently renewed to prevent corruption. How would that work?
In all kinds of ways. A non-binding constitutional convention. Schools teaching civics again. Parents telling their children what it means to live in a country like this. We use the language of democracy, but our founders used the language of the republic. A democracy is about rights. A republic is about duties. And we are not learning the duties of citizenship.
But there were fears of real democracy in the early days of the nation.
There were. Adams and Hamilton saw democracy as mobs in the street. Jefferson kind of liked the idea, as did Madison. But the founding debate was all conducted with the language of the republic and the sense of duty, commonwealth, resistance to corruption.
The founding fathers couldn't have anticipated the era of globalization as it has developed. What do you think that they would think of it?
Who knows?
Well, of course, we were talking about no entangling alliances in those days.
Yes. Well, we've gone well beyond that, as I document in the book. But
The reason I ask is you write, globalization indeed has led to the commercialization of the U.S. diplomatic system.
Yes. Well, our embassies since the end of the Cold War are, I think, frankly, to the good, helping American companies carry out activities abroad, including health care and a whole variety of other things. So that's not bad. What I'm trying to argue is not that lobbying per se is bad or that commerce per se is bad. That's not going to change. The founders, to respond to your question, were pragmatists. They would have adapted our policies to the age of globalization and information and so forth. But there's a big difference between policy and principle.
Well, one of the things I see as similar is that people were stuck very strong to their ideologies.
Yes.
And that was at the beginning, and we're seeing it today. The fact that the import-export bank is now in danger of extinction has more to do with ideology than it has to do with any practical thing.
Well, in recent years, I can't account again for 19th and 20th century. Recent years, the polarization of the nation, largely brought on by gerrymandering into red and blue states, and the polarization of the parties, particularly on the right, by the Tea Party influences and a collection of social conservatism interests, has dominated American politics, and it's been financed by the kind of corruption that I've talked about here.
Why do you think Occupy hasn't had more of a lasting impact?
The same reason gun control advocates aren't as visible as gun owner advocates.
My guest is Gary Hart, former U.S. Senator and presidential candidate, author of 21 books, including his doctoral thesis. 2001, was that?
Yes.
On Thomas Jefferson?
Yes.
And now The Republic of Conscience. It is published by Blue Rider Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Gary Hart, whose latest book is called The Republic of Conscience. It's published by the Blue Rider Press. We were talking a bit about globalization. Let's talk about foreign policy. It was pretty clear during the Cold War. But then you say everything had to be redefined after the fall of the Soviet Union and then 9/11. Are we still trying to figure things out?
Of course. What happened, it seems to me, starting in 1947 with the passage of the National Security Act, was a fundamental change of America's role in the world. The idea for Truman and others was we don't want to fight World War III, so we're going to leave troops around the world and we're going to keep our hand on top of things so we don't have to redeploy these forces in 20 years from now. But that then led to the surveillance state, not just of what the Soviets were doing, but what American citizens were doing. And to a degree, that also led to what I call the expeditionary state, American troops going into various places around the world, probably starting in Korea and moving all the way up to Iraq.
And pretty much everyone, with a few exceptions, ending in disaster.
You could make that argument.
I mean, we have been the most powerful nation in the world, and yet Korea, Vietnam, we were chased out of Beirut by an explosion. Iraq has been a disaster. Afghanistan hasn't been a complete success. What are the successes? Bosnia?
Well, I would suppose, but what was not recognized by foreign policy planners and some military planners was the changing nature of warfare. We were so used to the big divisions confronting each other and the tank battalions that we should have learned in Vietnam particularly that we were moving to an indigenous, unconventional, irregular kind of warfare. And it took us a long time to begin to adapt to that.
Shouldn't we have understood that because our own revolution was really an insurgency of that sort?
Yes, we should have. But again, you had powerful lobbies for the big army divisions, the big aircraft carrier task groups, the big bombers, and those are all Cold War weapon systems.
You're right. After 9/11, the George W. Bush years were guided by national security, but that the Obama years have been guided by don't do anything stupid.
I'm just reporting the facts. No, I think
is that a foreign policy?
No, it's pragmatism squared. It's make it up as you go along, depending on the circumstances. But we should have taken steps. the Bush administration wanted to dominate the Middle East. That's why we invaded Iraq. It wasn't about weapons of mass destruction. But we're still paying the price for that.
And now we have the whole issue of surveillance, which worries
yes.
you. But
worries a lot of people.
But a lot of Americans also say surveillance keeps us safe. How many people have told me, well, I don't care if they listen in on what I have to say. I haven't said anything that would get me in trouble.
Yeah. Or they say, as they do to me, I think we ought to monitor people's telephone calls, just not mine.
But they want to monitor yours.
Yes.
Well, you know, if you don't want people to know what you're thinking, you probably should stop writing books.
Yes.
You've written a manifesto for the 21st century for Americans, and in it you include the following. We do not intend to bring force to bear on those with whom we may disagree, and we do not expect them to bring force to bear on us. Do not tread on us, and we will not tread on you. Well, would that work with Al-Qaeda or ISIS or
no,
any number of other groups intent on bringing down Western thinking?
They are trying to tread on us, so we have no choice but to respond.
So what do you do when you're dealing with people whose ideas are shocking? Well, I don't know whether beheading people is that much more shocking than waterboarding people, but we're in a very weird extreme situation these days.
We are indeed. Well, what we do is what we're doing in part. We're using artificial warfare. We're using drones. We are not collecting intelligence as we should, because we don't know what ISIS next plans are. We need to know that. It's very hazardous to find that out. We need to form new coalitions, which we're trying to do, but not very successfully, simply because of the 1,300-year divide between Sunnis and Shiites.
On the other hand, it has been pointed out that there has been more homegrown terrorism that had nothing to do with Islamic thinking in this country, then more people have died as a result of people like Dylann Roof than the Boston Marathon bombers.
Yes, and shootings in Colorado, and the Newtown massacre of 6-year-olds. No, it's
and Charleston.
Yes, mm-hmm. And the list goes on. There are some serious social problems in this country of deranged people having assault weapons.
So is it all just a matter of gun control?
Well, no. I think
because people are being killed all over the world.
Issue. Yeah, these are profound issues. You've got a certain kind of young person. I don't think anybody has figured out why. You hear broken families. You hear failed schools. You hear deranged 20-year-olds that want to kill their parents and everybody else. Whether this is more than usual, you'd have to go back through American history, but they're certainly better armed than they ever were in the past.
My guest is Gary Hart, whose latest book is The Republic of Conscience. It's published by Blue Rider Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The basic theme here is that there's an increasing gap between purpose and performance
yes.
in America.
Well, I would say principle and performance. Our purpose is defined by our principles, who we claim to be and who we tell people we are. And we are asserting one thing around the world, but behaving differently. I think the classic of this was the secret bombing of Cambodia. This wasn't a secret to the Cambodians. They were being bombed, and they knew where the bombs were coming from. It was a secret to the American people. So you had officials of our government, elected officials and appointed officials, who were systematically deceiving the American people because to carry out what they knew the American people would not support if they knew about it. So you have to deceive the American people. Guess what? That causes a loss of confidence in government.
That occurred not long before you wound up running for office.
Yes, it did. Well, Vietnam. My early appointment in the Senate was to what was called the Church Committee, and we uncovered plots to overthrow foreign governments, some of which we knew about, plots to assassinate foreign leaders,
plots to get Castro's beard to fall out.
Among other things. Yeah, went on, and all of it hidden, not only from the American people, but from the Congress they elected.
But aren't there rules where they have to inform Congress?
Yes.
But even when they inform Congress, aren't those committees sworn to keep those secrets?
No. There is no.
That's what I've heard.
There is no oath of office to serve on the oversight committees. I was a charter member of the Senate Oversight Committee after the Church Committee. Congress now must be notified. If there is to be a major covert operation, the president must sign a piece of paper that led to the Iran-Contra scandal with President Reagan, who claimed not to know about it, but there was a piece of paper in his vault with his signature on it, authorizing it. So that has changed. The members of the Oversight Committee can discuss within the bounds of national security what they learn in their briefings. If they violate national security as they define it, then they are subject to dismissal by the voters.
In your final chapter, Reflections and Afterwards, you tell your own story of getting involved in politics, which began in a civics class when you were in the eighth grade?
Yes.
What about that class inspired you?
It really dealt with what this book's about, what the founders intended for America. And it included not just our rights, but it included the duties of citizenship. And I think that was the difference. And it stuck for some reason. And it carried forward. I did not intend to get involved in politics. My parents were not political, weren't even graduates of high school. But along came a presidential candidate in 1960 that talked the same language, and it resonated.
We're talking about John F. Kennedy.
Yes.
You write that Jefferson and, to a lesser extent, Hamilton knew that the large-scale republic that they were creating would only survive if citizens did their duty. We are talking about, in the case of Jefferson, a man who is a giant and then also a slave owner.
A flawed giant, yes.
No
question.
So did they understand? You think Jefferson even understood that dichotomy within himself?
Oh, he did. He talked about having the wolf by the ears, and he knew by punting on the issue of slavery just to get the Constitution adopted that they were kicking the can down the road and that ultimately a price would be paid. He knew that.
Now, many people talked about how political apathy had set in this country, and that seemed to have been suspended during the 2008 presidential race. President Obama's win looked like it would inspire a whole new generation, but that hasn't happened.
Well, you never know. I don't think generations are inspired. I think individuals are inspired.
Well, right now, if you ask voters, they'll say, my vote doesn't make a difference.
Many voters would say that, but I'm thinking about a 20-year-old, an 18 or 20 or 22-year-old who got involved in the Obama campaign and who was motivated by Barack Obama and the first African-American president and the change that represented, particularly from his predecessor, and who may end up running for the Senate or mayor or governor. You just never know what that impact is.
Although what it seems to have inspired more is Tea Party activism.
Well, certainly a reaction to the decision by a majority of the American voters twice to elect a Democrat and a African-American Democrat and one who wanted to institute a public a health insurance system. Yes.
I was interested in noting the reaction to the recent Supreme Court rulings, some of which were pleasing to liberals, some pleasing to conservatives. And yet liberals didn't call for the impeachment of the Supreme Court voters who just pretty much undermined the fuel, what is it, the power plant emissions ruling of the Obama administration, some of the other things that liberals would have been happy to have seen them vote differently on.
Yeah.
But why do you think every time the Supreme Court votes a certain way, people start screaming impeachment?
Depends on who the people are. I'm trying to remember, as you were asking, I was trying to remember a situation where so-called liberals were trying to impeach Supreme Court justices. I'm sure there were times.
Well, all I remember is Douglas being threatened.
Oh, yes, times. Exactly. Yes, yes.
But he was a liberal.
Your memory is better than mine. What we're hearing now is Rubio and people like him saying we should elect the Supreme Court. Give me a break. Talk about changing the Constitution.
Do you ever want to run for office again?
No.
What do you want to do? Write books?
I'd like to continue to try to have a small voice and talk to students, which I do a lot, and teach and make a difference. I'm probably different from most former elected officials in that I just can't give up. I know a lot of people wish I would, but I can't.
Well, I'm surprised you never became a lobbyist.
Not 10 cents. I've never made 10 cents lobbying, and I never will.
Gary Hart's latest book is Republic of Conscience. It is published by Blue Rider Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.